Welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire Community Radio. I'm Amy Antonucci, glad to be introducing our show to you today on April 2nd, 2005. Here's what's coming up. We'll start by hearing Tom Jackson interview Robert Jensen, professor, journalist, and activist, about his recent book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. We will then listen to an interview with Jan Schaefer from the AFL-CIO about women and work, which technical difficulties prevented us from airing last week as originally planned. Stanley Longstaff will present a report back about the Portsmouth City Council work session in regards to the resolution in support of the Bill of Rights this past Monday. We'll also have announcements, music, a poem, and more. First, let's go to Jeff White with some news.
Welcome to some news for Making Waves. And sorry, I'm running a little bit late today. This is actually live. This is going out live over the air. So bear with me, there's lots of good stuff to talk about. This was from the Berkeley Mike magazine, and this is a story about military recruitment. In what may become a historic step in the anti-war effort, as well as the lesbian, gay, and bisexual movement, the Associated Students of University of California at UC Berkeley have unanimously passed a resolution denying military recruiters use of facilities and assets because of the military's discriminatory don't ask and don't tell policy. Student Bill 20107 states that the presence of military recruiters on campus violates the University of California's own non-discriminatory policy and calls for the UC Berkeley administration and the UC Regents to take measures to bar military recruiters from UC Berkeley and throughout the UC system. Much of the success of this resolution can be attributed to the November 2004 Fair versus Rumsfeld ruling by the Third Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. The ruling states that universities may bar military recruiters from their campuses without risking the loss of federal money, which has been a major deterrent in anti-recruitment efforts. In addition, the Student Senate passed a resolution calling for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. And in another story in the Free Press Washington, some of George W. Bush's supporters seem to be going overboard in their efforts to stifle dissent when he comes to town to talk about changing Social Security. In Denver, three people say they were booted out of a presidential event last week, even though they had never uttered a peep, apparently because their car had bore a bumper sticker denouncing the war in Iraq. In Fargo, North Dakota last month, local Republicans developed a blacklist of more than three dozen residents, including a city commissioner, who were to be banned from Bush's visit. White House officials say they have nothing to do with the exclusions, which they blame on overzealous supporters. Quote, "We welcome a diversity of views at the events," White House spokesman Scott McClellan said Tuesday, "although, in fact, participants at the events are carefully screened and dissenting voices are rare. There was no welcome mat for Alex Young and his two companions when they showed up to see Bush on March 21st in Denver. Bush was there for one of the series of talks about his plan to change Social Security. Young and his friends, Karen Bauer and Leslie Weiss, had barely gotten into the door before they were shown the exit by a man who refused to explain his actions. They thought he was with the Secret Service, but because he had an earpiece and he had an official-looking lapel pin. Young said later that he was told by Secret Service officials that he and his friends had been ejected by a local Republican volunteer who had been spurred to action by the bumper sticker on their car, No More Blood for Oil. The thing that set them off was the bumper sticker, Young said. It was completely unprovoked. The whole time he was really pushing and shoving me. We were never told that only Republicans were invited. Complaints about tight restriction at Bush's events have become common. His presidential campaign used tight crowd control screens last fall, and similar tactics now seem to be employed at official presidential stops. Unlike campaign events, they are paid for with taxpayer dollars. Okay, and this from The Guardian. One of the most respected figures in the Republican political establishment turned on his own party this week, accusing the leadership of falling hostage to the religious right. In an opinion piece, In the New York Times, John Danforth, a former senator and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, writes, "Republicans have transformed our party into the political arm of conservative Christians." Mr. Danforth's credentials in the party as a three-term senator from Missouri's heartland and as a minister chosen by Ronald Reagan to officiate his state funeral in June 2004 are well established. His broadside against the party's rightward shift in recent years appeared to crystallize growing unease over the increasingly political nature of religion in public life in the U.S., prompted by the public feud over the Terri Schiavo case. That affair has split the U.S. right, and in recent days, Republicans have tried to distance themselves from the controversy because of negative public reaction. A recent poll last week found 82% of Americans opposed to efforts by George W. Bush and Congress to intervene to prolong Ms. Schiavo's life against the expressed wishes of her husband. In his article, Mr. Danforth taps into the sense of disquiet over the erosion of the separation of church and state. Quote, high-profile Republican efforts to prolong the life of Ms. Schiavo, including departures from Republican principles, can rightly be interpreted as yielding to the pressure of religious power blocks, he wrote. His critique of the party went far beyond Ms. Schiavo and cited the party's active opposition to gay marriage as well as attempts in his own state, Missouri, to criminalize stem cell research. I am and have always been pro-life, he wrote, but the only explanation for a legislator's comparing cells in a Petri dish to babies in the womb is the extension of religious doctrine into statutory law. This story from the Associated Press. Though the Soviet Union is gone, the nuclear fears that fueled the Cold War haven't disappeared. Most Americans think nuclear weapons are so dangerous that no country should have them, and a majority believe it's likely that terrorist or a nation will use them within 5 years. North Korea claims that it has nuclear weapons now and is making more. Iran is widely believed to be within 5 years of developing such weapons, and security for the nuclear material scattered across the countries of the old Soviet Union remains a major concern and mystery. Two-thirds of Americans say no nation should have nuclear weapons, including the U.S., and most of the others say no more country should ever get them. The United States, Britain, Russia, France, and China have nuclear weapons, and Pakistan and India have also conducted nuclear tests. Many believe Israel has nuclear weapons, but that country has never acknowledged it. North Korea claimed in February that it had nuclear weapons. The threat from nuclear terrorism is greatest, analysts say, because terrorists with nuclear weapons would feel little or no hesitance about using them. That's why those who monitor nuclear proliferation are so concerned about securing weapon stockpiles and dismantling weapons as quickly as possible. Ironically, the funding to help track down and monitor these nuclear weapons in countries formerly part of the Soviet Union has largely been eliminated from the current U.S. federal budget. This story is from the Washington Post. This is a big story that happened this past week about the report that was released by our government on the weapons of mass destruction. As former Secretary of State Colin Powell worked into the night in a New York hotel on the eve of his February 2003 presentation to the UN Security Council, CIA officers sent urgent emails and cables describing grave doubts about a key charge he was going to make. On the phone that night, a senior intelligence officer warned then-CIA Director George Tenet that he lacked confidence in the principal source of the assertion that Saddam Hussein's scientists were developing deadly agents in mobile laboratories. Quote, Mr. Tenet replied with words to the effect of, yeah, 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 and that he was exhausted, according to the testimony quoted yesterday in the report of President Bush's commission on the intelligence failures leading up to his decision to invade Iraq in March 2003. Tenet told the commission he did not recall that part of the conversation. He relayed no such concerns to Powell, who made the germ warfare charge a centerpiece of his presentation the next day. That was one among many examples cited in over 692 pages in the report, a fruitless dissent on the accuracy of claims against Iraq. Up until the days before U.S. troops entered Iraqi territory that March, the intelligence community was inundated with evidence that undermined virtually all charges it had made against Iraq, the report said. In scores of additional cases involving the country's alleged nuclear and chemical programs and its delivery systems, the commission described a kind of echo chamber in which plausible hypotheses hardened into firm assertions of fact eventually becoming immune to evidence. Leading analysts accepted at face value supporting the existence of the illegal weapons, the commission said, and discounted counter evidence as skillful Iraqi deception. The commission's anatomy of failure on Iraq's alleged nuclear weapons program is a case in point. It begins in early 2001 as Bush took office, when the CIA got its first report that Iraq was trying to buy black market aluminum tubes. The agency swiftly concluded, after intercepting a sample in April of that year, that Iraq intended the tubes to be used in centrifuges that would enrich uranium for the core of a nuclear weapon. The CIA's Weapons Intelligence Nonproliferation and Arms Control Center, also known as WINPAC, never budged from that analysis, the report said. In the following 18 months, WINPAC, an analyst, won a fierce bureaucratic battle against dissenters from other agencies who said the tubes, roughly 3 feet long and 3 feet in diameter, were the wrong size, shape, and material for plausible use in centrifuges. The tubes became the principal evidence for a key judgment in October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate. To support its assertions about the aluminum tubes, the CIA made a series of arguments that the nation's leading centrifuge physicist described repeatedly as technically garbled, improbable, and false. And in the next story, this is from the Inter-Press Service. The American Civil Liberties Union is charging that U.S. Army documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that the mistreatment of detainees in Iraq was much more widespread than the government has admitted. The advocacy group also accused the Army of failing to comply with a court order to release the documents and of manipulating the media to minimize coverage and public access. The ACLU said the reason for the delay in delivering the more than 1,200 pages of documents was evident in the contents, which include reports of brutal beatings, exercise until exhaustion, and sworn statements that soldiers were told to beat the blank out of detainees. One file cites evidence that military intelligence personnel in Iraq tortured detainees held in their custody. The treatment was reportedly meant to soften up detainees for interrogation. And let's see, what else? In a separate development, the Center for Constitutional Rights, which joined the ACLU, said at least 26 prisoners who died in American custody in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2002 are likely the victims of criminal homicide. As a result of another investigation, the Army has decided not to prosecute 17 soldiers implicated in the deaths of 3 prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. Investigators had recommended all 17 soldiers be charged in the cases that included murder, conspiracy, and negligent homicide. The Defense Department declined to comment further on any of its reports. Acute malnutrition among Iraqi children aged under 5 nearly doubled last year because of chaos caused by the U.S.-led occupation, United Nations experts said yesterday. The UN Human Rights Commission's special expert on the right to food said more than a quarter of Iraqi children do not have enough to eat, and 7.7 are acutely malnourished, a jump of from 4% recorded in the immediate aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion. Reporting to the Commission's headquarters in Geneva, the Swiss professor claimed the situation was a result of the war led by coalition forces. And in another study, this was printed in the USA Today, and it states that as many as 1 out of 4 veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq treated at Veterans Administration, Veterans Affairs hospitals in the past 16 months were diagnosed with mental disorders, a number that has been steadily rising, according to the report in today's New England Journal of Medicine. Records show that 20% of all eligible ex-soldiers came to VA hospitals seeking medical treatment between October 2003 and February 2005. Overall, 26% of them were diagnosed with mental disorders. Post-traumatic stress disorder was most common, diagnosed in 10% of the patients, followed by drug and alcohol abuse, then followed by depression, anxiety disorders, and phobias and panics. Many soldiers had multiple disorders. Patients coming from the VA often lacked insurance and might be disproportionately higher risk for mental health problems, he said. Also, soldiers who have left active duty may be in more mental stress than those who stay.
We now go to Tom Jackson and his interview with Robert Jensen.
We're talking today with Robert Jensen, author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
In reviewing the book, it seems as timely, if not even more so, now. You wrote it in 2004, I believe, and talk a lot about not only post 9/11 politics in the United States, but also post February 15th, 2003, that being the day when so many people around the world got out in the streets and protested the impending invasion of Iraq. Could you maybe just first give a brief synopsis of what the book's about and why you felt compelled to write this book?
Yeah, I think it's important to think through this question of empire. Prior to 9/11, if you made the argument that the United States was an empire, you were usually labeled part of the loony left and laughed out of the room. But post 9/11, we've had an interesting shift in which even people on the right, even people in the centers of power, acknowledge that the United States is in fact an empire different in some senses than perhaps the British Empire or the Roman Empire, but an empire in the sense of having a worldwide reach through both military and economic power, and also empire in its most fundamental sense, which is the capacity to control the political sovereignty of other nations. And the United States has that capacity, and it exercises it frequently in order to concentrate its own wealth and power. That's an empire, and it's, I think, very important that we have finally, at least many of us in the U.S., have come to terms with the notion that the U.S. is an empire. The idea at the core of the book is that we are different in another sense, however, and that is we have not subjects. The British Empire, for instance, had subjects. The Roman Empire did not have a free and fully democratic system. But in the United States today, at least in legal terms, we are a democracy, and we are citizens of an empire. And I think the challenge, as I would put it in its most concentrated form, to the people of the United States today, is can we be something unique in history? Can we be the first citizens of an empire who, through internal political activity, end the empire? And I don't mean end the United States. I don't mean destroy the country. I mean shift the United States from an imperial stance to a stance of being not the nation on top of the world, but one of many nations in the world. And that's really what is the idea at the core of the book. How do we do that? How do we come to terms with the reality of our own history and our own place in the world today? And how do we move forward from that?
Well, it brings me to the subtitle of the book, the full title being Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And I agree with you that nowadays it seems widely acknowledged that the United States is an empire. But it's interesting to read the second part of the title, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's perhaps more controversial, because the argument I'm making, and is implicit in that subtitle, is that when you live in the empire, you cannot fully claim your humanity. That is, if your affluence, as it is in the United States, I think, if your affluence is based in part on the subjugation of people elsewhere, if we all know that in some way we are a rich and prosperous country because other people suffer historically and in the contemporary period, then we know that we don't really have access to our full humanity. We're not part of the world. We're disconnected from the world in that sense. And it's important that in the subtitle I call it The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, not to reclaim our humanity, because I want to also emphasize not only the sort of imperial nature of the U.S. today, but acknowledge that historically we are in this position of wealth and power because of a series of quite barbaric acts that created the United States. So I think that if we want to truly claim that humanity, we both have to come to terms with our history and the contemporary period. And then, of course, that leaves us with a challenge. Can we organize politically to try and change the nature of this government and this system? And I think I say system meaning not just the public face of it in terms of our government, but also the economic system in which we live. I'm one of those people who still thinks it's important to critique capitalism, to talk about why, in fact, capitalism and democracy are fundamentally incompatible from my point of view, and why this system of capitalism is the threat not only to equality around the world and democracy, but also a threat, quite literally, to the continuing sustainability of the planet, the ecological question. All of these things, I think, are right in front of us. They are pressing and compelling questions, and in a country that offers a lot of ways to avoid those issues, a lot of what I like to refer to as the cheap toys of empire, television, cheap food, easy entertainment, lots of ways to disconnect from the world, I think our challenge is to reconnect with the world and face up to these issues.
Throughout the book, you do, in developing your argument, you do a considerable amount of looking at some terminology and defining those things and defining the differences between certain words such as hope as opposed to optimism, being critical as opposed to being cynical, nationalism as opposed to patriotism. Can you just talk about some of those words and the differences between them for a minute?
Sure. In the bigger picture, when one faces political crises, when one sees the world in trouble and wants to act, I think we often want to say it's time to act, not to sit around and theorize, not to think. But this is actually a moment in which I think it's very important to theorize, and I don't mean that in a kind of academic and elitist sense, but in trying to understand how the world works. And sometimes that means trying to understand how language works and trying to look at ways in which language is used to keep us trapped. So, for instance, there's a chapter on the question of the support the troops rhetoric. We all want to be nice people. We all want to support our fellow countrymen and women. And so we often have a reaction where we want to support the troops. But I try to talk about how the whole support the troops rhetoric is designed to keep people away from political engagement, and we can't sort of fall into that trap. As you point out, I try and distinguish between what might seem like similar concepts but can be quite different. For instance, I talk about the difference between hope and optimism, which is a distinction many people have written about over the years. I talk about the fact that I'm not optimistic in the short term, but I have hope in the long term. That is, I look at the world, I see the way in which right-wing forces have really become extremely powerful in this country, and I'm not optimistic that I'm going to wake up tomorrow and see, a progressive revolution in the U.S. It doesn't mean I don't have hope that that can't be achieved, but I think we have to distinguish between our rational assessments of what is possible in the short term, because if we don't do that, then we often develop very unrealistic expectations. And I think we have to distinguish between those things and a longer period question, a longer term question of how to have hope, how to understand that people are capable of very creative action, and that we look back at history and see that even when short-term attempts to bring progressive change failed, those people who kept at it over time, who had hope for the long term, were often very successful. And here I think it's incredibly important for people in the U.S. to think a lot about history, because this is a very short-term, immediate gratification kind of society. And that's true not only of the mainstream culture, but that does affect the left and the progressive movements as well. And there have been many points in history when immediate short-term change just wasn't possible, and people had to dig in for the long term. Certainly that's the story of the labor movement. It's the story of the civil rights movement. It's the story, in fact, of every movement that has tried to challenge concentrated power. And I think we have to, pay attention to that so we don't develop unreasonable expectations and then be extremely, depressed and passive and paralyzed when those short-term expectations aren't met.
So now, getting back to putting the timing of coming out with your book, Citizens mm-hmm. of the Empire, to a post 9/11 and also post February 15th, 2003 world. Now here we are, post 2004 election, something that caused a fair amount of progressives and liberals a certain level of depression and frustration.
Yeah.
Just recently, the Senate snuck through a provision that opens up the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Every day we're hearing about deaths in Iraq and elsewhere. Where do people who want to somehow affect change find hope?
Well, here I might be a little unusual, because while I was not happy about the election of George Bush in 2004, I must say that I woke up that day without that sense of depression or angst that many people in the left progressive community had. And that's because I didn't have very high expectations. I thought the Democrats ran the worst possible campaign. I felt they had virtually no possibility of winning once the Kerry campaign made a strategic decision to abandon the anti-war movement and to really turn away from the one source of strength and energy that could have propelled the Democrats forward. Now, this was not surprising to me, in part because I have so few expectations from the Democratic Party in its current form. So I woke up, the day after the election, basically feeling the same way I did the day before, which is that there's a lot of work to build grassroots institutions in the United States that can carry forward left progressive political work. I happen to work in one in Austin, Texas, that we started about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And we have a goal. Our goal is to continue to work on issues in the short term, to organize people and educate people about the war in Iraq and about U.S. corporate globalization and those sorts of things. But also, our goal is to be around in 5 years and in 10 years. That is one of the things that typically we have not done very well on the left progressive side in recent decades, is build long-lasting institutions where people can know that down the road there will be the same folks there working on the same issues and sticking with it. And so I woke up the morning after the election and had the same work in front of me that I had the day before. And quite frankly, if John Kerry had been elected, I don't think that work would have changed. I think that the Democratic Party represents a different set of interests in the elite culture, but still represents interests from the elite culture. And my goal is to be part of the process by which we build a grassroots movement that represents ordinary people, not those elite interests.
In the latter part of your book, speaking of institutions, you talk about the educational system, particularly the college educational system, and, of course, the media. How can people who want to bring about change affect those and work with those institutions? It seems as though, in both cases, to a great extent, there's been a sort of massive scale of takeover or a sort of buyout, privatization, if you want to call it that, of those institutions, and their particularly mainstream media just seems so conservative nowadays. How can individuals affect change there?
Well, I think those are two very important institutions to think about, education and the news media. Now, it just so happens that I've spent my entire adult life as either a journalist or a teacher, so these are the two main ways in which we socialize people in this culture, and they are therefore incredibly important. How do we affect change? Well, it's a different question for each institution. On higher education, for instance, there is, as you point out, a move toward privatizing, toward reducing public funding and forcing universities into the private sector. And, of course, when you do that, those institutions will increasingly reflect the interests of the private sector. And we need to support public education, public support for higher education. Of course, there's also a very real threat today to academic freedom, to the right of university professors to pursue critical inquiry. We see that, for instance, most clearly in the attack on Ward Churchill at the University of Colorado. And so tenure and academic freedom, which may seem like rather arcane issues to people outside the university, are in fact very important to the intellectual and political health of the country, I think. So there are places where people can move on those two issues. In the media, I think it's a very complex but very important strategic question. How do you try to create a more democratic media system? Well, the first thing, as you point out, we have to observe is that the U.S. media system kind of unique in the industrial world, is almost completely commercial. There's no meaningful public broadcasting system in the U.S., for instance. So one question is, how do we try to create political support for public broadcasting that would be truly independent, both of corporate interests and of government interests? There are ways in which I think we can try to support those within journalism who really do have the ideals that have always motivated the best journalists. That is, the ideals of, you know, to use the old phrase, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. Well, there are journalists working in the system who would very much like to be able to pursue those kinds of goals, and a public movement can support them. I think things like strengthening the union for journalists, a very weak unionized industry, for instance, would be helpful. And then, of course, there's alternative media. And it's important to recognize that alternative media are important not only for the unfiltered news that you can get, that is, news not filtered by the corporate media, at least. They're important to us in the way they deliver information to us. But they're also important in the way that they push the mainstream media. There are many examples when stories that break in the alternative news media can affect how the corporate commercial news media work. And so there are all of those things, you know, trying to create a better structure for public broadcasting, trying to support journalists in their willingness to do good work, and of course supporting and using alternative media. All of this is part of a media strategy, I think, that can be quite exciting. And there's work going forward on that. I know and many people are probably familiar with a group called the Free Press, which is organizing around questions of regulation of broadcasting, for instance, trying to put the public into that issue more directly. There's a conference in St. Louis in mid-May that will take up some of those issues. So there's a lot of places where people can today go lend their efforts.
Can you give us an example of a story that broke in alternative media that went on to affect mainstream media somehow?
Sure. The successes here are sometimes few and far between. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but take a story people might be familiar with. In the 1980s, in 83, 84, folks may remember that Donald Rumsfeld was appointed a special envoy by the Reagan administration to go to Iraq and try and smooth things over with the government of Saddam Hussein. So this monster that we are told about so often, who in fact was truly monstrous, was in fact a U.S. ally through much of the 1980s. And there was actual footage, video of Donald Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein. Some may be familiar with the famous still photograph taken from that of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. Well, that story was broken. The fact that meeting happened and the consequences and conditions under which that meeting went forward, that was broken by an independent journalist, a man who was a producer for Democracy Now! And also an independent journalist. And it made its way onto the web, and eventually the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, those kinds of places, did have to run stories acknowledging this. Now, it was important not just because it kind of pointed out that Donald Rumsfeld was a hypocrite, which is hardly news in that sense, but it pointed out the bigger story, which is that the United States had been supporting Saddam Hussein through some of the worst of his atrocities in the 1980s. And that U.S. interests were not around democracy and freedom. U.S. interests in the region were around control and domination. So that's one example of how that kind of work by independent journalists can affect the mainstream. And I think to the degree we help fund, and it's very important to stress, independent media needs financial support. They can't do what they do, you know, on a wing and a prayer. But the degree to which we fund and support that kind of journalism, it will have increasingly effects, I think, on the mainstream.
You talked a few moments ago about the difference between hope and optimism. Another difference that you point out, or a couple of terms that you talk about in Citizens of the Empire, it's the difference between being critical and being cynical.
Right.
And, of course, many, many people, I've experienced it, and I know a lot of people who are listening, who take a progressive stance on politics and who are progressives at heart, get into discussions with people and are accused of being cynical when they're just being critical. But could you kind of describe the difference and why that's important to distinguish that?
Yes, I think it's a crucial difference. I spent much of my life being cynical. And I was a journalist, and journalists tend to be cynics in general. And I thought, that being cynical made me smarter than everybody else. And it was only sort of later in life, after I started to become more politically active, that I realized that cynicism is actually a very self-indulgent and, frankly, quite juvenile reaction to the world. Yes, the world has problems. Yes, people seem to routinely behave in ways that are often impossible to fathom. Yes, there is suffering that sometimes, is beyond description. All of that's true. It's also true that the world is full of solidarity and compassion and people who rise above their own self-interest to do quite extraordinary things. And a cynic looks at only the negative and then, I think, in sort of self-congratulatory ways, comes to the conclusion that nothing is possible and then retreats. I think someone who is critical but engaged looks at the world in all its complexity, looks at the good and the bad, and asks, how do we move forward to try and make the world a better place? Now, for a lot of people, to express that, I think they're afraid of being called naive or idealistic. Maybe it's an odd world we live in which the word idealistic is now an insult. I hear students actually say that. Someone will express a very clear and passionate argument for justice, let's say, and other students will say, well, you're just being idealistic. Well, sure, and isn't that a good thing? I mean, shouldn't we encourage that? Shouldn't we, help people articulate the best ideals of being human? So, it's understandable why people want to retreat, because the world is, in very many ways, an ugly place. But the world is also, in very many ways, a beautiful place. And cynicism, I think, keeps us from recognizing the world in all its beauty and complexity, but also keeps us from acting. And that's really why people in power don't mind a cynical world. I think the folks who run this country would be very happy to see everybody sort of collapse into cynicism, because cynical people don't take political action. And critical people, people who are engaged, can take political action. So I think that distinction is incredibly important.
And one other distinction in terminology that you make that I think is absolutely crucial as a citizen of the United States in 2005 is the difference between nationalism and patriotism. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, yes. And here I have a view that's somewhat different than many. I think we often talk about nationalism as a negative force, that kind of jingoistic, my country right or wrong conception of nationalism, and I agree that's extremely dangerous and extremely, I think, juvenile again. It's a very limited way to see the world. What people often say then, but patriotism, love of country, a real love of country that includes the willingness to be critical and dissident is somehow acceptable. And in that chapter, I try to point out that, from my point of view, patriotism and nationalism are essentially always the same thing. I'm not only against that kind of jingoistic nationalism, that very chauvinistic nationalism. I'm, quite frankly, at this point, arguing against any conception of patriotism for a very simple reason, is that our allegiances, I argue in that chapter, shouldn't be to a nation. A nation is an arbitrary political unit. I think our allegiances in the world should be toward principles and ideals that we can universalize, that is, let's say the concept of real freedom or real democracy, which I think we should want to make universal. I think we should have a commitment to those ideals, and we should have a commitment to a collective humanity. That is, I think we have to get past the point where we think there's anything special about being in this country, or that there's any special connection we have to people in this country. I try to think of my obligations and connections to the world, not to a nation. So, in a sense, what I'm arguing is that I think patriotism is a kind of an artifact of history that we're going to have to get beyond. We've seen the destructive capacity of nation states. And I realize it's quite an undertaking to say, let's start thinking beyond the nation state, since our whole world, of course, is organized around the idea of states. We are citizens of a country. And I think that's one of the things that over the long term we're going to have to challenge, much in the same way I would argue we're going to have to think about how to challenge over the long term capitalism. Because from my point of view, the world cannot survive nation states and capitalism for much longer. These are, I think, inherently systems that concentrate wealth and power, and I don't think we can continue on that path indefinitely. So while we're working on short-term issues, let's try to stop the war. In fact, let's try to build a country in which war is not a policy option. All of those things are important, but it's also important to think creatively about the long term, about what kind of political organizations, what kind of economic organizations are really sustainable over the long term. I think those questions are important. I realize they can seem abstract, and in some sense it's easy to want to push those aside toward the more important and pressing issues, but I do think we have to always keep talking about them. I think one of the important political questions we have to face in this country is often not seen as political, and that's the level at which we live in the U.S. That is the incredible affluence of this country. I think this is the most affluent country in the history of the world. And even those of us who live perhaps, you know, not at the elite level, we're not all Donald Trump, but most people in the United States live at a level of comfort that is really unknown in much of the world. Half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. The striking figure that I think always need to keep in the forefront of our imaginations as we try to work politically. I think this leads to a conclusion that is often very difficult for people, which is if we are going to really create a just and sustainable world, that is, if we are going to transform this world, it means, from my point of view, that the living standards of people in the United States are going to have to change, and that means change downward. That is, we are going to have to start consuming less. We cannot live at this level of affluence indefinitely if we want to bring both justice and sustainability to the world. Now, I don't think that means that it's our obligation to wake up today and sell everything we own and become impoverished, because that's not going to do anything to bring justice to the world. But we do have to start thinking about how are we going to step back from a high-energy, high-consumption lifestyle, because this lifestyle is not only not generalizable to the rest of the world. That is to say, if the rest of the world lived like we do, there would be simply no way the planet could continue. It's also not sustainable even if it's contained to the first world. That is, if the first world continues on this path, it's, from my point of view, highly unlikely that we're going to make it into the next century. Those are serious questions. I don't think there are simple answers to them, and I certainly don't think I'm in a position to dictate to people how they should live. But I do think this fundamental question of how can we scale back the way in which we live to a more just, that is, a level that we can try to bring to the rest of the world, and a more sustainable, that is, one that can truly be sustained over the long term, is at the heart of any progressive politics in the world today.
Okay, Robert Jensen, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great conversation and important subject.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I wanna be just like my president. I wanna make more money than I can spend. I wanna build more bombs than I can send to somewhere I can't even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big Big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Come all you black and Hispanic boys, we'll keep you poor, so you got no choice but to join the army in your prime and fight for Uncle Sam and die. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
That was Sputnik Weasel with New American Century. Now we're going to hear a poem in honor of National Poetry Month, which is April. Our friend Cynthia, a Seacoast librarian and an active citizen who believes in the power of words to reach into people's conscience and sense of justice, will be reading for us.
This poem is called Beatitudes by Alfred de Zayas. He lives in Geneva, Switzerland, and the book that it's from is Poets Against the War, edited by Sam Hamill, Thunder's Mouth Press, 2003. Beatitudes. Can you tell me who is good and who is bad? The ancient we and they divides us artificially. Yet for the children of New York and Baghdad, only one equation counts, their shared humanity. Woe upon the men who would unleash a war, regardless of the risks, impervious to the law. Alas, the many nations that such crimes abhor may fail to stop the programmed shock and awe. But silence now would make us guilty, too. Protest we must. Prevent preventive war. Who are the victims? Who the victimizers? Who? Ourselves, our leaders, to the White House, mirror. Blessed are the peacemakers, children of our God. Deplore the wielders of the sword. They must one day account. Now George is seen in church, but does he grasp the core of Christianity, the Sermon on the Mount?
Now, in this century, the ideology of power and domination has appeared again. Small groups of men seized control of great nations, built armies and arsenals, and set out to dominate the weak and intimidate the world. In each case, their ambitions of cruelty and murder had no limit. A brutal dictator, with a history of reckless aggression, with ties to terrorism, with great potential wealth.
He has shown utter contempt for the United Nations. Of the world.
And tonight I have a message for the brave and oppressed American people. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
And Bush, if you really want to get Saddam, get in a plane, jump out in your parachute, and have a one-on-one with Saddam with yourself.
War crime. In the Garden of Eden, baby, began an attack on military targets in Iraq.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against our staunch friend, Great Britain. Australia, Germany, and France, more than 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and across Asia. These carefully targeted actions are designed to attack the Islamic faith. This military action is a part of our campaign against diplomacy, intelligence, freedom.
George Bush wants a regime change. I want a regime change too at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
The Nazi war criminals attempted to defend against this charge by arguing that some of the wars they waged were preventive warfare or preemptive warfare. And the Nuremberg judgment dealt with that quite firmly and rejected this Nazi doctrine of alleged self-defense. So what we heard Cheney make in his two speeches was a Nazi philosophy of international law.
Here in the garden of the Illuminata, we've done all we can. You say we're playing games, we've given in to your demands. So come to Mesopotamia, march into the promised land. On the banks of the Tigris, we shall make our final.
Liars. We go on television and say things that we know are absolutely not true.
What we are really struggling against is a war for oil, a war to advance American imperialism, a war that will destroy human lives.
It's not about peace. It's not about democracy. It's not about justice. It's a war about oil, and it's a war where the main beneficiaries will be the arms manufacturers who've made so much out of so much misery for so long.
People won't even realize that our biggest contractor is the former president's firm, because we've done pretty well when the war drums beat.
Bush is talking about weapons of mass destruction. And when I look at the White House, I'm more worried about words of mass destruction.
Too late. smaller fry. Why should they, great Capones, fallen headpiece seek, when stolen crowns sit easier on the head? Or Ethiopia's band of gold for higher prices on the market can be sold, or Iraq oil, than any vice or bootleg crown.
Just heard The Compassionate Conservatives with In the Garden of Eden, followed by The Jolly Bankers with Ways of the Gangsters. The Jolly Bankers is made up of Pierce Woodward, who is a local singer-songwriter traveling around, touring at the moment, and his friends, Kristen Andreasen and Laura Cortese. And that song is a tune that they put with a Langston Hughes poem called Ways of the Gangsters.